Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening. It's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Trump administration has done a dramatic about-face on Syria, moving aggressively in the direction of escalated U.S. intervention in the war on behalf of opposition forces fighting to topple the government. What's the real story behind the alleged chemical weapons attack and the fast-moving political developments inside of Washington, D.C. that have followed? Donald Trump met with King Abdullah of Jordan at the White House as the two leaders discussed the possible revival of Palestinian-Israeli negotiations. But is this real or is there another agenda? After calling for a controversial new referendum on Scottish independence, Nicola Sturgeon has embarked on a 5-day tour in the United States. Are pro-independence forces correct in their assertion that Scotland could maintain its economic and diplomatic clout as its own country? But first we turn to Syria. We are joined from London by Catherine Shakdam. She is a political commentator whose latest book is called A Grand Tale of Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Welcome back, Catherine.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Thank you. Catherine, this is from the Washington Post yesterday. At a joint press conference with Jordan's King Abdullah Wednesday, Donald Trump said that his attitude about Syria's President Bashar Assad and about Syria has, quote, changed very much, close quote. He repeated his accusations that the Obama administration issued a, quote, blank threat, close quote, to the Assad government that using chemical weapons would result in consequences. Trump says it was not one of our better days as a country when the previous administration failed to act on those threats. He acknowledges now, quote, I have that responsibility and I will carry it out proudly. What's the Trump administration preparing, in your opinion? Is a military strike coming?
Yeah, I think he's making, well, I don't know if it's coming, but he's definitely making a very strong case for war against Syria. You know, his administration came out as well saying that, you know, if the UN wasn't willing to intervene, then the US, you know, would have no other recourse but to intervene and do something about it, which I found really hypocritical. I mean, Donald Trump was talking about, you know, innocent babies dying. There are many innocent babies dying in Mosul, for example, by the hands of the U.S. There are many innocent babies dying everywhere in the world by the hand of the U.S. or its close allies, you know, and I'm talking about Yemen in this particular case. So it's very, I mean, the degree of hypocrisy, double standard and demagoguery is actually sickening at this stage, because we all know that from the very moment that he actually stepped into the White House, he has been trying, his administration has been trying to find a way into Syria. So it started off with safe zone and then it didn't work out. So they tried something else. And now, you know, we have this chemical attack, which I found very convenient, happening in Idlib. And then suddenly everybody wants to go to war within 24 hours. It's ridiculous. When you think about, you know, the number of blunders, if you want to call it that, that the US has been guilty of over the decade. And, you know, no one ever made a case for war against the United States of America. So what gives the US or any other Western capital, for that matter, the right to actually completely dismiss the possibility that President Bashar al-Assad is actually telling the truth? Because there is no evidence on the ground that suggests to the contrary. And that, in fact, you know, this chemical attack was an accident and was actually the result of the likes of Daesh having access to chemical agents. And the real question is, how in the world did they get access to chemical agents? And we know that those chemical agents would be used to make bombs to be then targeting civilians either in Iraq or in Syria.
Catherine, let me jump in real quick. And because here in the United States, and probably where you are as well in London, the media is inundated with the absolute assertion that the Assad government used chemical weapons against its own people. And I agree with you 100%. I mean, it makes no sense that they would use the one weapon that would invite foreign intervention at a time when the Syrian government is actually winning the war and consolidating its gains. So from a point of view of motivation, it just doesn't have a motivation to use chemical weapons. But you said it was an accident. Help the broader audience understand, because, again, people are just getting their news from the mainstream media. What do you think happened?
Well, the way that he was described is not so much what I think, is what was reported, is that an airstrike happened, and the airstrike happened to target a warehouse that happened to contain chemical agents, hence, you know, the so-called chemical attack. What happened is that the warehouse that was housing chemical agents was bombed, quite rightly so, because those chemical agents otherwise would have been used, you know, for creating bomb and targeting civilians. I don't think that the actual bombing of that particular warehouse might have been an accident, in that they did not know what was in there, you know, and therefore they could not preempt on the result. But the point is, it just actually should scare people, not because civilians died. Yes, civilians died. It happens during a war. But we need to realize that you have Daesh militants in possession of such, you know, weapons of mass destruction. That worries me. That worries me more than having Washington trying to stage a kind of a boohoo moment, trying to use the death of civilians, which is, of course, tragic in itself, but trying to stage this to actually argue yet again, a military intervention in a sovereign country. I mean, we have another repeat of Iraq. You know, enough with the false flag, enough with targeting Syria and arguing that President Bashar al-Assad is using chemical weapons against his people. It makes no sense for him to do so. Should he choose to do so, he would have done so ages ago against Daesh militants. Why now? Why now, when he's just about brokering a truce and that things are actually working in his favor? Why would he want to mess it up when he has been such a good strategist in trying to maneuver, you know, the political mess that the US has made for him and the military nightmare, you know, that the US and its allies and Saudi Arabia and others have made for him? It's ridiculous. I mean, for someone that has managed to survive for 6 years of unprecedented attack against his government, against Syria's sovereignty, against his people, to actually make such a mistake. I mean, do not insult, you know, the Syrian people and just assume that, oh, yeah, suddenly, you know, he decided to become a war criminal. It's insanity.
Catherine, I want to ask you about the trajectory, or what appears to be a rapidly evolving trajectory within the Trump administration. You had, of course, the National Security Advisor Flynn. He was forced out. General McMaster has come in and replaced him at the National Security Council. Steve Bannon, who was a right-wing populist with the Breitbart organization, an outsider, so to speak, but from the right, he had been named in an unusual decision by the Trump administration to be part of the Principles Committee, in other words, part of this strategy-making group, the small group, the inner core with the National Security Council. Yesterday, he was forced out. In other words, if you look at the Trump administration as a coalition of right-wing populists, generals and very conservative billionaire oligarchs, a part of that coalition was just forced out of a very important position. And it appears that the neocon leadership, McMaster being a representative of it, of course, Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, Secretary of Defense, another big part of it, John Kelly, the Board of Homeland Security, in other words, a government of generals, they are now consolidating their authority. And at that moment, and the day after this very weird chemical attack, and weird meaning it would be weird for the Assad government to do such a thing under these circumstances, when it was consolidating a road towards peace and its own victory. Do you believe that what's going on is a sort of an internal internecine civil war within Washington? In other words, over both Russia and Syria policy? How do you see it?
Yes, absolutely. No, I agree with you. And the thing is, you know, I actually have been talking about this for quite some time. There is a war within, you know, within what I call the establishment in Washington, where you have, you know, there's a power grab here and a power play in between the neocons, you know, the deep state and others who are trying to actually carve a way forward, a different way forward, where war is not necessarily the default setting. And I think it's very difficult because, you know, Syria has become, I think, a power broker in that everything will be decided over the fate of Syria. What will happen in Syria will determine, you know, how Washington will shape its future. It's very complicated and it's so dangerous right now to take any rash decision. And of course, when you have President Trump sitting in the White House, it's actually quite scary because he's not very well known for being rational in his decisions. And he says things before he actually thinks them. And that's even more scary for me because, you know, any missteps could actually be completely catastrophic, knowing, you know, what powers are involved in Syria. We can't forget that, you know, Russia and Iran are involved militarily speaking, in Syria. And whatever happens in Syria could then, you know, kind of spill over to Iraq and then could influence what happens in Turkey. And then in turn, that could actually set the entire region on fire. And I'm not talking rhetorically, I'm talking literally set the whole region on fire, because you would unravel very, very dangerous ley lines. And I'm talking Lebanon, I'm talking Turkey, I'm talking Syria, Iraq, you know, and beyond that, you have other countries such as Yemen and Bahrain and Iran. It's very dangerous. And I'm just hoping that someone's going to have two brain cells to actually rub against each other and realize that there is no need for war. And that, you know, this chemical attack is not an excuse for war and should not be an excuse for war.
Right. But I believe that it is, in fact, being used. And maybe that was the purpose of the the way the media commented on it all around. If it was an accident, or if the rebels had chemical weapons, or whatever the case, because, of course, we don't know with exactitude. But if we were looking at this from a point of view of to see who is the beneficiary of it, we would have to say that the rebels who are on their last leg, this is Al-Qaeda we're talking about, the organization that the United States identified as its number one enemy in the war on terror starting in 2011, on their last legs, they can't survive without foreign intervention. The Trump administration had said just 2 days ago, that the overthrow of the Assad government wasn't a priority because it could not happen. In other words, they were giving up on the idea of regime change. Why would the next day that same government, the Assad government, use chemical weapons, which, of course, would reach such a calamitous cascade demand for intervention? Now, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, she's Trump's ambassador, hinted at the possibility, too, of direct intervention. She said, when the United Nations consistently fails in its duty to act collectively, there are times in the life of states that we are compelled to take our own action. That means if Russia or China, either of them, say, veto a UN action authorizing the use of force against Syria, Nikki Haley is certainly suggesting, I think, really making it quite clear that the Trump administration and perhaps most importantly, the Pentagon are prepared to intervene militarily in Syria, not against ISIS, not against Al-Qaeda, but against the Syrian Arab Army. Go ahead.
But it's insane, because when you think about it, first of all, do you know what I found very interesting, and is who mainstream media is actually quoting to prove that President Bashar al-Assad did in fact authorize, you know, the so-called chemical attack? They're actually quoting a guy whose, I forgot his name, is Hassan Haj Ali, and he's actually the head of the Free Idlib Army, and that's a euphemism for Al-Qaeda. So they're actually taking their cue from a guy who's a very well-known terrorist. So in itself, big question mark.
There are no independent journalists, I don't believe, in Idlib.
No. So, you know, therefore, big question mark on this. But to top it all, to have someone, you know, to have a diplomat to actually make the case for war on account of allegations that can't be proven just yet, and to suggest that the UN is not doing its job because suddenly the UN is not aligning its policies with that of America, again, you know, exceptionalism needs to end at some point. And how many wars will Washington argue, you know, against sovereign nations before someone actually turns around and say, what about we turn the tables on you and actually decide to say, well, enough of you, you know, warring everybody else. What if someone was to intervene against the United States? Because you can't make this kind of allegations and case and not expect that someone at some point in time will turn it against you. This argument is not valid. It's not a legal argument. It's not even a diplomatic or political one.
Catherine, we have about 4 minutes. Back in 2013, in August, matter of fact, on August 29th, 2013, when President Obama was being pressured to bomb Syria because the report was by John Kerry that on the very day a UN inspection team was arriving in Syria to look at the possibility of war crimes, the argument was that the Syrian government at that moment used chemical weapons, that had crossed a red line that Obama had set, meaning he assumed then that Assad and the Syrian government would never use chemical weapons because that would invite U.S. intervention. But at that time, Donald Trump, when the pressure was on Obama back in August 2013, he tweeted this: what will we get for bombing Syria besides more debt and a possible long-term conflict? Obama needs congressional approval. And then he tweeted again the next day, if Obama attacks Syria and innocent civilians are hurt and killed, he and the U.S. will look very bad. Then he tweeted, The next day, how bad has our, quote, leader made us look on Syria? Stay out of Syria. We don't have the leadership to win wars or even strategize. Now Trump is now blaming Obama for being irresolute back in August 2013. But at that time, when he was not yet even a candidate for president, he was telling Obama, don't be suckered. Don't do it. This will only be a catastrophe. Why is Donald Trump changing right now, given the fact that he said he wanted to normalize relations with Russia and that Assad should not be the principal enemy, ISIS and al-Qaeda should be? Why is Donald Trump changing?
Oh, I think there's a very powerful lobby, if not two, actually, you know, pressuring him. I mean, we have to realize that. I mean, who is financing Daesh? Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia right now is losing ground everywhere, in Syria, in Yemen, and in Iraq. It doesn't want to lose in Syria, because it loses in Syria, it loses everywhere else. And so it's pressuring Washington to come and intervene and basically save its boys, Daesh, in Syria. It's very quite simple. The problem is people refuse to actually link all those dots together because they don't like the picture. But the picture is still here, and it's kind of staring us back in the face. So it's about time for us to wake up and realize that the problem that we have is that the Saudi lobby is not very powerful in Washington. So if you bear in mind what is happening in Iraq and Syria, you're going to want to rethink foreign policy, because do you really want those guys to be in charge of your policies? Because I certainly don't want them to be in charge, because they're absolute psychos. And that scares me, to have Donald Trump to actually renege on his word and make the case for war and now suddenly turn into like the grand neocon. Because what? Because Saudi Arabia has paid him to say so, or because they're pushing for these kind of policies now? They want the big bad wolf of America to come and save them. I mean, it's making the case for Daesh. You are actually saving Daesh by targeting President Bashar al-Assad. Who in their right mind will do that? Why do that?
I agree with you. But there is another lobby in addition to the Saudis, which is right here in Washington. The Washington Post ran an opinion piece yesterday entitled "The Syrian Genocide is Now Trump's Problem." And after running through a list of politicians who the author Jennifer Rubin considered insufficiently pro-intervention, she gets to the point, however, Trump is now commander-in-chief. He must decide whether to continue our passive approach and watch continued genocide unfold, or whether he should chart a new course. I believe, Catherine Chakdam, that what's actually happening in Washington is that the Washington Post and the military-industrial complex, who have been beating up on Trump because they disagree with his policies and who he is, they're also offering him an olive branch. If you turn the tide, if you go to war against Syria, and of course that would break any possible relations with or normalization with Russia, then we will let you back into the neocon fold. That's what I think. That's what I think is happening. But I've taken the last seconds. Catherine Chakdam, we're out of time. Catherine is a commentator from London. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump has met with King Abdullah of Jordan at the White House as the two leaders discuss the possible revival of Palestinian-Israeli negotiations. But is the Trump administration serious about forcing the apartheid government of Israel to the bargaining table? We are joined in studio by Miko Peled. He is an activist and the author of the book, The General's Son, The Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Welcome back, Miko.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining. Trump and King Abdullah spoke at length at the White House on Wednesday. Then they had a press conference. Was their meeting important? Is Jordan key to the possibility of relaunching Israeli-Palestinian negotiations? Is that what's coming?
I don't think so. I doubt that very much. I think that it's Jordan is key, and these discussions are key in maintaining the facade of a desire to somehow resolve the Palestine question. I don't think there's any substance to it whatsoever. Everybody knows that there is no two-state solution. Everybody knows that Israel doesn't care about Arab recognition, doesn't need Arab recognition, doesn't care about peace, doesn't need peace, and will continue to maintain its oppressive and brutal apartheid regime as long as the state of Israel remains in existence. So I don't think there's any substance to this at all.
At their annual summit meeting last week, the Arab League leaders renewed an offer they made first to Israel in 2002, recognition by dozens of Arab and Muslim nations in exchange for allowing the creation of a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Why does the offer continue to get turned down by Israel?
Israel doesn't care about Arab recognition. Israel doesn't care about peace, and Israel doesn't need any of those things either. Israel is the strongest power in the region. The countries that used to be called the refusal front, which were the countries that supported the Palestinian cause and refused to deal with Israel, and that list included Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen, are all destroyed. The countries that collaborate with the U.S. and Israel and have continue to collaborate with Israel and with the U.S. Sisi was just here from Egypt. King Abdullah of Jordan is here. The Gulf states and Saudi Arabia and so forth. So Israel is doing fine. Israel has absolutely no incentive to change anything, and Israel really is incapable of changing anything because the very existence of the state of Israel is the issue. This idea that somehow there could be a peace with Israel is proven to be complete nonsense. The only way that Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace is outside of the state of Israel. In other words, without the existence of the state of Israel and the replacement of the state of Israel with a real democracy that recognizes the rights of all people who live there. So this idea that there could be this two-state solution and that Israel cares about recognition and this regurgitation of what is called the proposal of the Arab League and so on is just a facade to keep this thing alive.
Israel is a settler colonial project. South Africa was a settler colonial project. The United States of America was a settler colonial project. These projects, at least in the case of the United States, it never made peace with the indigenous people. It wanted their land. It took their land. It carried out genocide against them. Eventually, of course, the European migration was so strong that the indigenous Indian peoples, in spite of their combativeness and consciousness and desire to remain free, they were overwhelmed. In the case of South Africa, the majority black African population was indomitable as well, but they had numbers. I mean, they were greater than the settlers, and eventually the settler regime had to adjust. And formal apartheid, many of the privileges of the South African ruling class remain where they were with the white ruling class politicians, but there's officially black majority rule. You're suggesting then that under these circumstances with Israel, under these conditions, Israel is not going to make any adjustment. Then what is its plan? Does it have a plan?
This is the plan. What we see today in Palestine is the execution of the Zionist plan. Jews are doing fine. They live everywhere and anywhere in the country that they want. There is no West Bank. There's Judea and Samaria. There's the Galilee. There's all these other different. It's all part of the same country. It's all part of the same state. Jews live under the same rules and governed by the same laws, regardless of where they live throughout the country. So it's really insignificant to call some of them settlers and some of them not settlers, whether they live in what used to be the West Bank and is now called Judea and Samaria, whether they live in Jerusalem, whether they live in Tel Aviv, it makes no difference. These are all settlers. They're all sitting on stolen Palestinian land. All of the state of Israel is occupied Palestine. And this is and the reality that exists today is perfect for Israel. It's perfect for Israeli Jews. The segregation is incredibly deep to a point where Israelis don't care, don't know, and don't see Palestinians at all. Whether they are, again, whether these Palestinians are Israeli citizens or not makes no difference. The Palestinians are governed by different laws depending on where they live. So some of them have some sort of a kind of a quasi-citizenship. Some of them have, if they're in Jerusalem, then they have a kind of a quasi-residency. If they're in the West Bank, it's something else. If they're in Gaza, it's something else. So Israel has this divide and rule organized very, very well. And everybody's fine. Israelis are doing fine. So there's really no reason for anybody to assume that Israel has any incentive or would ever agree to do anything else. If we seek justice, if we seek the right of return, if we think that Israelis and Palestinians should one day live as equals and peacefully side by side, then we have to get used to the idea that the Zionist regime, which is the state of Israel, has to be removed, just like apartheid was removed in South Africa, and replaced by a one person, one vote, a real democracy that will eventually allow the equality to take place, that will eventually allow justice to take its place, which will eventually allow the Palestinian refugees to return, lift the ban on their return, a ban that has been in existence for 7 decades now. This is the only way forward. Anything that includes the state of Israel as a state of Israel guarantees there will be no change.
You are an Israeli. The Israeli government argues and its apologists argue that ending the state of Israel means a return to the situations of Holocaust, to genocide. But what you're talking about is the end of the state of Israel as is constituted as a Jewish state, as an exclusivist Jewish state, would not be a genocide. In other words, the right of Palestinians to return to their villages, the right of these refugees and their offspring to come back, it could be handled in a way so that Jew, Muslim, Christian, non-believer, in other words, the people of the area could, in fact, live in peace.
Well, up to this point, and over the last 7 decades, Israel has been engaged in genocide, Israel has been engaged in ethnic cleansing, and Israel has been engaged in maintaining an apartheid regime for 7 decades. So to assume that for some reason, if this ended, that would mean the reverse is quite far-fetched. There's no reason to believe that. There's no reason to expect that. There's no reason to assume that. So the first step is to end the bloodletting of Palestinians, to recognize the rights of Palestinians, to recognize that justice must be served, to recognize that the Palestinian refugees must be allowed to return, and then to create a political reality where, like you said, the people who live there live as equals, and the rights of that Israeli Jews like myself enjoy are shared by everyone. There's this very dark picture which is sometimes painted, whereby if Palestinians are granted rights, that takes away from the rights of the Israeli Jews. That's not a realistic picture. What we're talking about, or the reality as I see it, is one where everybody shares the same rights. That doesn't take away from somebody else's rights. It takes away the privilege, but it doesn't take away the rights.
King Abdullah is a king, and he's meeting with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is also engaging with Bahrain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the monarchies. I mean, these Arab governments are monarchical governments. They exist as a, I don't know, residue from an earlier era, blood monarchies, absolute, you know, in most parts. Maybe it's not an absolute dictatorship in the case of Jordan, but certainly there's not a lot of freedom or democracy there. Why are these monarchies going through at least the facade of standing up for the Palestinians and wanting to re-engage with Trump and with the Israeli government on a two-state solution? I mean, we know that Trump, after he became president, or perhaps right before, said, well, one state, two states, I don't know. You know, we don't have to be stuck on this two-state thing. In other words, a typical cavalier Trump comment. Why are the monarchies doing it?
Well, the existence of the monarchies is dependent on the mercy of Israel and the United States. So they will do whatever they're told. And right now they're told to participate in this game, participate in this facade of the two-state solution. It also helps them internally somewhat, because it shows as though it shows that they care somewhat about the Palestinians. And of course, being Arabs, they need to show some care for the Palestinians. Although there was a great picture from that was posted online last week or so during the summit, the Arab summit, showing a bunch of these older, not all of them were monarchs, some of them were presidents, but all of these dictators asleep during the deliberations, during the debates, during the summit, which exactly shows how much they care. Their existence has nothing to do with the will of the people, which is why they're relying on Israel and the U.S. to maintain their regimes. They will do whatever they're told by the U.S. and by America and by Israel. And right now, what they're being told to do is maintain this facade. I think it's quite well known that if these states had democratically elected leaders, then the reality would be very different. I think these monarchs and these leaders also know that if they do not toe the line, they will end up like Iraq and Syria and Yemen and Libya. So it's better to, you know, toe the line and maintain their existence as it is than to end up like one of those other countries.
It's interesting the fact that you mentioned that Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, the resistance countries within the Arab world, the non-monarchies, the regimes that came really out of an anti-colonial project. I mean, they were originally either pan-Arabists or communists or Baathists. In other words, some strand of the anti-colonial, anti-imperialist struggle. It was cross-class in many instances, but they came from that anti-colonial project, unlike the monarchies, who came as an extension of the colonial project, just as Israel does. Last week, it was reported that Israel was bombing in Syria. Syria was firing back. Syria says it actually shot down an Israeli plane. I don't know if that's true or not or verifiable. But why and how is Israel intervening in the Syrian war? Of course, the Syrian war remains at the top of everyone's headlines. But what's helped the audience understand how does Israel proper, how does the Israeli government view the Syrian conflict right now?
Well, there are several advantages to Israel by maintaining the war in Syria. First of all, when Arabs kill Arabs, it's good for business if you're Israel. Because it shows how Israel is stable, how Israel is democratic, how Israel is not violent, and so forth. Because when Israel commits massacres in Gaza, it manages to sell this, wrap it up, and sell it as self-defense. And it's been very successful in doing that. So the world doesn't treat that the same way as what is happening in Syria. So it's good for business because, again, it shows Israel as kind of an island of stability, of Western European values and so forth. And it also acts as a smokescreen. As long as people are looking at Syria and are shocked by what is happening in Syria, then they're not looking at Gaza and they're not looking at the Palestinian situation. They're not looking at the Palestinian condition. And in comparison, people can say, well, look, how can you talk about the Palestinians when the Syrians are suffering so much? So it works very well for Israel when terrible things happen in Syria. And Israel has a lot to gain from this. And I think Israel will do pretty much anything and everything in its power to make sure that stability does not come to Syria.
We're talking with Miko Peled. He's an author. He's an Israeli citizen who's here. He's an activist. Miko, when I was in Iraq a number of times before the first Gulf War and then before the 2003 invasion, I spoke with Iraqis who were government officials, members of the Ba'athist Party, as well as normal people. And a lot of them were puzzled about why the U.S. was attacking Iraq, because Iraq wanted to be the friend of the United States, including Saddam Hussein had been collaborating with the United States in the war in Iran. They were convinced that it wasn't the U.S. imperialist policy towards the Middle East, in other words, dominating this oil-rich and geostrategically important region that was driving policy, that the U.S. was doing the bidding of the Israeli government. I mean, they were convinced of it. I thought there was an intertangling of agendas, but I didn't see it quite that way. How do you see it?
I agree that there is an intertangling of agendas, and I don't think the lines are absolutely clear. But what is absolutely clear is that the Israeli lobby and pro-Israeli members of different administrations over the years have been pushing very strongly for the destruction of Iraq and for these punitive measures of these countries that I listed earlier that were the refusal front. So there's no question that Israel is behind this. I think both sides benefit from this. Americans wouldn't do it. American administrations wouldn't do it if there wasn't something in it for them. But clearly Israel is behind it. Clearly the Israeli lobby is behind it. And there's a bigger picture here that as long as the Arabs are seen as bad, as long as Muslims are seen as bad, Israel stands to benefit. Because again, the comparison is Arabs and Jews, Muslims and Jews, and look at these wonderful Jews and look at how they made the desert bloom and so on and so forth. So it is very beneficial to Israel to have America identify Arabs and Muslims as the enemy. And that's exactly why they're behind this. And that's exactly how this is happening. And this isn't happening only recently. This has been going on for many, many decades. This pushing of the Arabs and the Muslims as irrational, as violent, as terrorists, and so on and so forth here in America.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We're out of time. We've been joined in studio by Miko Peled. He is an activist and the author of the book, The General Son, The Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. After calling for a controversial new referendum on Scottish independence, Nicola Sturgeon has embarked on a 5-day tour of the United States. Are pro-independence forces correct in their assertion that Scotland could maintain its economic and diplomatic clout as an independent country? We are joined from Scotland by John White. He is the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. Welcome back, John.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining. Talk about Nicola Sturgeon's trip to the United States. Talk about who she is and what the SNP is, what they're trying to do right now. Of course, She's meeting with governmental leaders, say the governor of the state of California, but not Donald Trump. I don't think Donald Trump's part of this itinerary. Go ahead. Talk about the big picture here.
Well, Nicola Sturgeon is the First Minister of Scotland, of the devolved Scottish government. She's also the leader of the Scottish National Party, which, as the name suggests, was formed on the premise of achieving Scottish independence from the UK. Now, in the wake of the EU referendum that took place in the UK on June 23rd last year, a constitutional crisis has ensued, because despite the EU referendum throwing up a UK-wide vote to leave the EU, 52% across the UK voted to exit, or Brexit as it's called, as opposed to 48% who cast a vote to remain. In Scotland, an overwhelming majority of people who voted in that referendum voted to remain, 62% as opposed to 38%. Now, Nicola Sturgeon since then has called on the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, to arrive at some compromise whereby Scotland's vote could be respected, the wishes of the Scottish people with regards to EU membership could be respected, along the lines of Scotland retaining membership of the single market whilst remaining part of a UK that is out of the EU. I know it sounds complicated, but that's the situation. Now, every attempt Nicola Sturgeon has made in the context of being the First Minister of Scotland to try and arrive at a compromise, every attempt has been rebuffed by Theresa May. And so Nicola Sturgeon now has no choice other than to call for a second referendum, which she called for through the Scottish Parliament. She received a mandate for that call. And so now they're at loggerheads, because Theresa May has basically said, which is her constitutional right, that she will not countenance allowing another referendum on Scottish independence until the Brexit negotiations are being completed, which could be up to 2 years or even more, given what we're hearing from the EU in recent days. So there's a real crisis here in the UK. Brexit has only succeeded in kicking over a constitutional hornet's nest. And it's in this context that, that Nicola Sturgeon has embarked on a five-day tour of the US, ostensibly to promote trade and investment. But everybody knows that perhaps an even more important purpose, given what's taking place in the UK, is to try and curry support for Scotland's case to call for a referendum and to be an independent country.
Scotland, while she's in the United States, has signed a pact with California to tackle climate change, a joint agreement committing the Scottish government and the government of California, which of course is the largest state in the United States and by itself probably the sixth largest economy in the world if it was a separate, independent from the United States. They made this agreement to tackle the problem on climate change. It was first signed by First Minister Sturgeon during her U.S. tour. Sturgeon met with the governor of California, Edmund Brown, in Sacramento to discuss how the two administrations can work together and provide a model for other governments to follow. Now, is that for Scottish domestic consumption, or what's the strategy here by Sturgeon?
It's very clever, because every time she makes these calls and every time she tries to arrive at these agreements, she's bolstering the case for Scottish independence, because she's acting as the leader of an independent country in arriving at these agreements. And obviously California is a leader in climate change, in renewable energy, and so Scotland, because Scotland geographically is suited to renewable energy and using the natural resources that Scotland has in wind, wave, solar, to try and embark on the development of renewable energy and thereby benefit the green economy. And so that makes perfect sense. But on the political level, it makes the case that Scotland is a nation in its own right, that's making these decisions in its own right, and that is a player on the world stage. And we're better to do that than California, as you say, the largest state, the richest state in the US. And also, there's a massive Scottish diaspora in the United States. Jerry Brown has got Scottish genealogy in his background, and she's tapping into that as well. And obviously, she's over there. The Tories are not happy the way that she's over there, and especially the timing, because there's a real grievance being carried here now in Scotland because of the continual refusal of the Tory government to countenance Scotland being allowed to hold a second referendum. And so for all these reasons, Nicola Sturgeon has really got the ball at her feet. And I think she's playing a very, very clever game. And she has done, it has to be said, since the referendum. She's cleverly navigated the currents, the storm that has ensued as a result of this Brexit result, and much more cleverly it has to be said, than Theresa May, and certainly much more cleverly than Jeremy Corbyn at this stage.
In what way more clever than Corbyn?
Well, I think Corbyn, it pains me to say, it has been steamrolled. He's tried to hold to a position that we're going to respect the result of the UK-wide referendum. So he's abstracted the national question in Scotland. He's abstracted the national question as it pertains to the north of Ireland, which also voted to remain. And there's much more serious consequences, potentially, with regard to Ireland, with the talk of a hard border being imposed between north and south. And that would have real serious consequences, potentially, for the peace process, which is far from being solid. It's very fragile still, despite being enforced since 1998. And so Jeremy Corbyn has tried to play to this UK-wide vote. But I think, Jerry, there's something even more ominous with regards to Jeremy Corbyn. I was on your show before debating some voices from the Brexit side on the left, and they were saying basically that Jeremy Corbyn was not a sincere Remainer, that he was only holding to that position insofar as he had to, as leader of the Labour Party, to appease his shadow cabinet. And I do actually think that they actually were telling the truth, that this was not politicking on their part. Jeremy Corbyn is a Benite. He is devoted to the Benite policy on Europe, which is anti-Europe. And I think it's told in the lacklustre campaign that he fought during the EU referendum campaign. And I think he's becoming increasingly irrelevant because of the polarisation that has emerged on the back of Brexit between those who want a second referendum, whether it's on the terms of Brexit, or those in Scotland who want a second referendum on Scottish independence as a consequence of the democratic deficit that has emerged.
What will happen to the UK should Scotland leave, one? And two, there are many, many, many problems that Scotland as an independent republic would, as an independent nation would face, including having to apply to the EU for membership. It wouldn't just be grandfathered in because as part of the UK they would just come in. They'd have to start from scratch, which also means that the EU central bureaucracy would have to evaluate a Scottish debt and the Scottish economy. They would have some say-so over how Scottish controls its own economy, because self-determination in the context of entry into the EU, into the neoliberal capitalist EU-dominated market, is a very, very restricted kind of self-determination. So talk about that, if you would.
Well, the first thing to be said is that we've had conflicting noises coming from the EU with regard to Scotland's status, should it leave the UK and reapply to join the EU. But a very interesting development in that respect has emerged in recent days, where the Spanish Foreign Minister, as you know, Spain has been cited as a country that would veto Scotland joining the EU as an independent country, worried about separatism in its own country vis-a-vis Catalonia, especially. But the Spanish Foreign Minister has come out and said that Spain would not veto Scotland's application to join the EU should it leave the UK. So that's massive.
That is surprising. I mean, given the fact that Spain is the peoples of Spain, you have not just one people, but peoples, just as the UK has Scots and Irish and English. So what accounts for that proclamation by the Spanish government then?
Well, I think there's a massive moral case and there's a massive democratic case for Scotland based on the issue of the democratic deficit in terms of the breakdown of the vote that took place last year at the EU referendum. But there's also something even more at play here, that I think there's a growing feeling across the EU that the UK needs to be taught a lesson, because this sets a very dangerous precedent. Theresa May and the Tories have been very arrogant in how they've treated the EU, talking about, you know, we want all these favours, we want this deal, as if they're going to dictate the negotiations. They're not. The negotiations will be dictated by the EU, i.e. Britain's deal. Will it still have a free trade arrangement? There's talk of a bill that will have to be paid by Britain to leave. And there's voices within the British government saying we're not paying anything. So there's been a very, very, very poor judgment on the part of the Tory government and its supporters, and certainly the hardline Brexiteers when it comes to the EU. But something even more explosive has taken place, and that is the status of Gibraltar has been put back on the table, which, as you know, is a British overseas territory, has been since the 18th century, the beginning of the 18th century. It was seized by force in 1704 during the Wars of the Spanish Succession. its British sovereignty was ratified in 1713 at the Treaty of Utrecht, which brought to an end to this, the Wars of the Spanish Succession. But Spain has a claim that's rooted not in international piracy, but in international law, specifically UN General Assembly Resolution 1514 and 1860 on the decolonization of former colonial countries. And so Gibraltar is connected to Spain. It's part of Spain. There's 30,000 people there who enjoy British citizenship. They want to keep it. But the EU has said that as part of the negotiations to determine the nature of Britain's exit, Spain will have a veto when it comes to Britain being able to have free trade with Gibraltar. And so that this has caused all sorts of problems here in the UK, with even leading politicians saying that Britain would go to war, if you can believe it, to maintain Britain's status as a British overseas territory. So I think the Spanish announcement by the Spanish foreign minister is connected to that diplomatic row that has exploded in recent days.
Very, very interesting.
Because of the strictures that are in place under the terms of the EU membership, I don't think Scotland's best bet is to become a full member of the EU. I think it would be much better joining the European Economic Area alongside Norway and Liechtenstein and Iceland, because that would mean that it would not have to sign up to the euro. It would have to pay a fee to gain access to the single market, but it would not have to sign up to the EU, the euro. But most importantly, it would not have to keep to the 3% budget deficit cap as per the Lisbon Treaty. And that means Scotland could run a deficit for the purposes of investment in public services and in jobs and in infrastructure and so forth, and sort of follow a demand-led economic policy. And that's very important for people on the left.
And besides you recommending that, is Nicola Sturgeon or others in the SNP, is that being actively discussed?
Some voices in the SNP are looking for that. The SNP is a broad church. It's a nationalist party. So it gets all, there's various political currents, right and left. But that would be a fight that we would have in Scotland if and when Scotland did achieve independence. It doesn't mean just because you support Scotland's right to independence doesn't mean you naturally support the SNP. And so I certainly do not support the SNP, but I certainly support this time round Scottish independence based on Brexit, which I think, as I've said on your show before, is merely the UK manifestation of the rise of the right and far right that's been taking place across Europe in recent years.
John White, let me ask you this. England and Wales both voted to leave. They voted for the Brexit. Scotland, Northern Ireland voted to remain. One of the big issues in the campaign was the issue of immigration and emigration. People within the EU countries had the right to relocate, live, and work in each other's countries. So you have a significant number of people from Eastern Europe and Central Europe, for instance, living in the UK, and even more perhaps from the UK and perhaps more from England, living places where, I don't know, where it's warmer, like in Spain. One of the big issues is what will happen to these people. In other words, will they be forced to move, leave their homes, leave their businesses, etc.? Or will there be sort of the maintaining the status quo even after the UK leaves the EU? What's the situation in Scotland? Has there been much EU relocation of people into Scotland, or has it been mainly in London, mainly in England?
No, there's a large EU migrant population in Scotland. The National Health Service all over the UK is staffed with doctors and nurses from all over Europe, and also outside Europe, for that matter. Big Polish communities in most Scottish towns and cities, a lot of Eastern Europeans, as you say. So Scotland does have a big EU population, and we want to maintain that. I've made it very, very clear. These people are workers. I don't make any differentiation between a worker who's born in Scotland, who calls himself or herself Scottish, and one who does not. They're workers. They're part of the working class, and they should be treated as such. And I think it's utterly deplorable, especially people on the left who are supporting Brexit on the basis that migrants lower wages. Migrants don't lower wages. Bosses lower wages. And that's why the trade union was formed, to interdict in that process of supply and demand. Else, what is the trade union movement for? Else, what is socialism for? So this has become a big issue. On the level of the Brexit negotiations, the Tory government has refused to guarantee the rights of the 3 million UK-wide EU citizens currently living in the UK and working in the UK. Many of them have been here for years. They've got families. They pay tax, and yet they were denied a vote, which I think was a monstrous moral outrage, given that this vote was largely on their fate. And there's estimated to be between 1 and 1.5 million British citizens living and working throughout the EU. And that's going to be, they're going to be part of the negotiations. And it's utterly deplorable, as I say, that these people are essentially being used as bargaining chips. How can that be? How can that be moral? That's one of the most ugly aspects of this process and this issue that obtains, the fact that they've got human beings who are now sitting worrying about if they're going to be allowed to stay here. This cannot be in 2017, surely. This is like the 1930s.
Yeah, or very much like what's happening in the United States, although I think even in the United States more severely, with thousands, tens of thousands of families are being broken up almost every week because somebody got stopped at a stop sign or somebody got picked up when they were dropping their kids off to school. It's a terrible, terrible human suffering. We're completely out of time. We've been talking from Scotland with John White. He is the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.